Good morning. Well, it's a new year, and so it's an appropriate time for us to shift gears and return to the Gospel of John. It's been a while since we've been in this book, but it's always great to be immersed in a gospel, because it's easy for us to replace Jesus with a religious life, forget who Jesus is, forget who we are. Now, if you know John at all, a lot of you do, you know that he's unique compared to the other Gospels. And he's unique on at least two levels. One is that his language and vocabulary are unique. His vocabulary could be included in the vocabulary of a first or a second grader. He uses metaphors and images that are very common, things in ordinary life, things like wind and birth, water and light, bread and wine. But his metaphors are like a pebble that's thrown into a pond. The circles just get wider and wider and wider. And the more you reflect upon John, the deeper you understand your relationship with God. Second, John's story is very unique. He tells his story completely different than the other three gospel writers. There's nothing about Jesus' birth, baptism, temptation, or transfiguration. Remembering Jesus by partaking of the bread and the cup is not included in John. Jesus does not sweat blood in the garden. He doesn't go before the Sanhedrin. He doesn't cry out on the cross about God forsaking him. He does not include a single parable. Instead, John's story is built around seven signs and seven I am statements. The number seven points us back to creation and to completion, to fulfillment. John's story is about a new creation in the beginning. After the signs, there are lengthy discourses and there's conversations with people, longer conversations than we find in the other Gospels. All kinds of people. Eugene Peterson writes, John is a most leisurely storyteller. He takes his time, he repeats, he circles back upon himself. He uses words lovingly, savoring them, or he holds a sentence only slightly to shift the angle of refraction and bring out another color. John is more of a poet. His Jesus is mystical. Sometimes when we're reading John, we miss the fast-paced action of the synoptics, but if we just want the facts, we're going to be sadly disappointed. We learn in John that we do not get the Christian life from a drive-up window. We have to slow down. We have to reflect. John's major themes of believing and loving do not come quickly or easily. Now, the place where we return in John's story is John chapter 8. And there we find a very familiar story, the story about a woman who is caught in adultery. Now, I have to tell you that it's highly unlikely this story was part of John's original manuscript. It's absent from most early manuscripts and from the church fathers. The language that we find in the story is different from what we find in the rest of John. It's much more in line with the synoptics. However, there's no reason to doubt the truth of the story, because it is similar to other stories that we find in other sources and especially in the other Gospels. So why does the story appear here? Well, let me propose a couple of reasons, and I'll give you a couple more later on. Firstly, the story is sandwiched very neatly between two scenes that are connected with the Feast of Tabernacles, which is the context for chapter 7 and chapter 8 and probably chapter 9 as well. Prior to this story, Jesus stands up in the temple on the last day of that great feast and proclaims that he is living water and that everyone who believes in him will also become a source of living water. And then right after this story, Jesus is going to proclaim that he is the light of the world. The story here at the beginning of chapter 8 is illustrative of what it means to be living water. And it's illustrative of what it means when light shines in the darkness. This is what Jesus does. This is what we are to do. Secondly, it's just a very great place for an illustration. John is he's a preacher. And John has this wonderful interleaving of discourse and story, discourse and story. Nicodemus, a woman at the well, the healing of the paralytic, healing of a blind man, the raising of Lazarus. They're all intermixed with the discourses that we find in John. So let's get to the story. We begin at the end of chapter 7. Everyone went to his home, but Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Early in the morning, he came again into the temple, and all the people were coming to him, and he sat down and he began to teach them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman caught in adultery, and having set her in the center of the court, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman has been caught in adultery in the very act. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. What then do you say?" They were saying this, testing him, so they might have grounds for accusing him. The story begins very abruptly. Again, the context is the Feast of Tabernacles. What we find right before the story is John's proclamation on the last great day of that feast. Following that, everyone left. Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. And it's very reminiscent of the language that we find in Luke about the Passion Week when Jesus was staying in Bethany and he would stop at the Mount of Olives. And perhaps that's even the setting of the story. Early in the morning, Jesus went to the temple and people gathered around him to hear him teach. He probably is in the outer court. This is where teachers would meet with their disciples and their students. While Jesus is sitting and teaching, these scribes and Pharisees approach him. They pretend to treat him with respect. They call him teacher, rabbi. But they're not there to listen to Jesus. Instead, they drag a woman into the court and they place her in the middle of all that's taking place and stand back and they leave her all alone. The woman is caught in the act of adultery, the very act. She's seized and arrested. Of course, there's no mention of the man or his whereabouts. Either he was fleeter of foot or we find some very chauvinistic men. One might also wonder how the religious authorities knew the woman and what she might be up to. When the Pharisees approach Jesus, they bring up a question of the law. However, they're not interested in justice or they don't care about the woman. The woman is simply a pawn in their game. They want to put Jesus on the spot to test him. Now, what law would these scribes and Pharisees be referring to? Well, that would depend upon whether the woman was married or single or betrothed. Deuteronomy 22 lays out the punishments for unfaithfulness, and there's three cases. Case one, a man marries a woman who claims to be a virgin, finds out later she's not, is substantiated, she is stoned. In the second case, death is prescribed for all unfaithful wives and their lovers, but no mode such as stoning is laid down. The Mishnah said that they were to be strangled. The third case, stoning is the biblically prescribed punishment for a betrothed virgin who is unfaithful to her fiancé. But the punishment is to be meted out to both partners. Very, very serious consequences for unfaithfulness. However, there is very little evidence to make us believe that stoning was carried out very often in first century Palestine. The scribes and the Pharisees are trying to set up Jesus to have a way to accuse him, to bring a charge against him. If he disavows the law, his credibility would be instantly undermined. He would be dismissed as a lawless person. If Jesus upheld the law, he would be supporting a position that was unpopular and probably not in use. More importantly, it would not square well with his teaching on compassion. One could imagine the tension in the crowd as they wait for Jesus to respond. Jesus stooped down and with his finger wrote on the ground. But when they persisted in asking him, he straightened up and said to them, "He who is without sin among you, let him be the first to throw a stone at her." Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. When they heard it, they began to go out one by one, beginning with the older ones. And he was left alone, and the woman, where she was in the center of the court. What does Jesus do? He simply stoops down and he writes in the ground with his finger. In fact, we read that he writes twice. We're not told the reason. Maybe we shouldn't bother to try to speculate, but we can't help it. Perhaps Jesus was imitating the practice of Roman magistrates who first wrote their sentence and then read it. Or perhaps Jesus was referring to a passage in Jeremiah 17 where we read that all who turn away on earth will be written down. Others suggest that Jesus was referring to two separate verses in Exodus chapter 23 regarding giving a false witness. Or perhaps it was not the content of what he wrote, but the action of writing. Jesus writing with his finger reminds us of another instance where God wrote with his finger. At Sinai, he wrote down the Ten Commandments. And we might recall that he wrote those commandments twice. We see in verse 7, the scribes and the Pharisees were persisting, continuing to question Jesus. Jesus responds with an invitation for the one without sin to throw the first stone. Now, this is a clear reference to Deuteronomy chapters 13 and 17 that instructs the witness, the one who gives the evidence, to throw the first stone. Witnesses don't have to be perfect, but they can't be guilty of the particular sin that they are witnessing against. And when it came to sexual sins, the woman was much more in jeopardy than a man, since the man could skate with a wink. Women always suffer more than men in this kind of situation. Jesus cuts through the double standard. The scribes and the Pharisees leave, one by one, beginning with the oldest. Some manuscripts say that they were convicted by their own conscience. Those who had come to shame Jesus now walk away, they themselves, in shame. And then Jesus turns to the woman. Straightening up, Jesus said to her, "Woman, where are they? Did no one condemn you?" And she said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus says, "I do not condemn you either. Go, from now on, sin no more." The scribes and the Pharisees leave, and Jesus is left alone with this woman. She's still standing there, paralyzed. She's afraid to move. What will happen now? Jesus addresses the woman respectfully, "Woman." The same term he uses to address his mother at the wedding of Cana and Mary in chapter 20 of John's Gospel. He doesn't ask her if she's guilty, only if there is anyone who condemns her. And then he says that he does not condemn her either. He instructs her to simply go her way and from now on sin no more. The story ends as abruptly as it started. Now, this is a familiar story. There's a lot of obvious truth. But it's important for us to flesh it out and take it to heart if we're to truly understand what a relationship with God is all about. And what I would have us do is to consider the three characters in the story. First, we have the scribes and the Pharisees. In other words, the religious leadership. For the Pharisee, the proper religious code is the important thing. External appearance, doing the right thing, looking right. A Pharisee is much more concerned with the externals than he is with the heart. The Pharisee sees himself as superior, does all the right things, while he looks down at other people, especially sinners, and he judges them. He sees people's weaknesses and imperfections and is not afraid to point them out. The Pharisee may be well-meaning, but they are blind to their condition. The story illustrates very well something that Jesus says in chapter 7 and chapter 8. Do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment. You judge according to the flesh. I am not judging anyone. But why are the Pharisees so upset? I think there's something deeper going on here. Even though Rome rules Palestine, the religious leaders are the top dogs. They're the power brokers. They're the CEOs, the CFOs for religious life among the people of God. They are the members of the elite group. They control the playground at recess. They're in charge. And Jesus is upsetting their world because he is seeking to eliminate the distinction between them and a sinner. And they don't like it. It's threatening their power, and they want to eliminate the threat. Remember, Feast of Tabernacles, connected with the Exodus event. What happened in the Exodus? God gave His people His commandments, His Ten Commandments that Brian has just been talking about. But then He had to rewrite those commandments. Why did He have to do that? Well, Moses came down from the mountain, and what had the people done? They had made a golden calf. They had fallen into what? Idolatry. What's idolatry called in the Old Testament? Adultery. God's people always played the harlot whenever they would worship Baal instead of Yahweh. Perhaps the story here is pointing out that Israel is doing the same thing now than they did in the past. By writing twice in the ground, Jesus is saying that the scribes and the Pharisees are the ones that are committing adultery. They are the ones that should be on the witness stands. They are the ones that should be being questioned, because their religious performance has become idolatry, and it has replaced a relationship with God. In the story, the Pharisee is a negative example. I think we'd all agree. I mean, none of us would want to be a scribe or a Pharisee, right? None of us see ourselves that way. So then, why do we find so many churches and so many leaders in churches who are like scribes and Pharisees, wanting to maintain control and are threatened by the work of the Spirit and the life of a sinner? There's always this pull to focus on morality as the way to solve the problems with the human depravity. And there's always a pull for us to be part of the in-group, the elite group, the powerful group, whether it's a church or home or work, even though we do not like what they stand for or approve of their tactics. See, most of us have some sort of Pharisaical tendencies where we create a veneer of how we want people to see us, and then we pronounce judgment on other people. We convince ourselves that we are superior. And what does Jesus say? Let him who is without sin cast the first stone. Second, we have the woman. She's in the wrong spot at the wrong time, making thunder under the sheets, doing what she shouldn't be doing. And she's paraded in front of this temple and placed in this in the middle of this group of men who are using her as a pawn in a much larger game. What a spot to be in. Amazingly, we don't even know anything about this woman. Unlike the woman at the well, this woman doesn't speak very much. We don't know if she stands in front of these men filled with fear for her life, or paralyzed with guilt and shame over her sin, or sternly defiant, or whether she could care less. We don't know if she wants God's grace. We don't know if she wants Jesus to save her. But I would have to imagine that she feels quite strange and on the spot. I remember when I was in high school, I took a summer school class at a school in a not so good part of Omaha. And I remember getting on the bus after that class one day and going home. And I kind of stood out like a sore thumb. And suddenly I became the attention of a lot of boys on the bus. And they began to ridicule and throw insults. That felt strange. You begin to ask, oh my gosh, how am I going to get out of this? The woman feels very strange. I can imagine that the woman is a member of Sinners Anonymous. You know the line, "Hi, I'm Terry. I'm a sinner." And I can imagine that she also feels like she's a member of the least, the lost, and the left out. Somewhere along the line, this woman got lost. Probably has been abused and taken advantage of by men. She's been made to feel despised and worthless. She probably has been treated as an unclean outcast. I can imagine that many of the women here could empathize with her, because many, many women suffer the indignity of being mistreated and mishandled by angry and selfish men. The woman represents the way people often feel when they come to church: condemned, judged. The spotlight is on them. They feel unwelcome, different, unclean. Being around a Pharisee is like seeing a policeman. You immediately look at your speedometer and making sure you're not going over the speed limit. You're afraid. You're scared to death of doing anything wrong, and so you walk on eggshells. And you never, ever, ever risk exposing your heart, because somebody is going to trample it down. The least, the lost, and the left out become the fodder for church people who take pride in their clean appearance. And the ironic thing, here's the ironic thing, is that church people are focused on being a part of that in-group or that elite group so that they won't have to feel like the least, the lost, and the left out. And they separate themselves so they can view themselves as superior. Conceal, cover up with a mask of respectability. So what happens? Sinners come to church and either they reject the church completely or they conform to a code of behavior to find acceptance. For a person like the woman, the church can become the biggest obstacle to knowing God and experiencing true healing in the heart. You know, I'd say most of us, most of the people here, most of you, if you were truly honest, would say, "I too feel part of the least, the lost, and the left out." You know, it might be easy for me to stand up here and present to you an image that I've got it all together, especially the way my wife dresses me. But to be honest, I know all too well what it feels like to be more lost than found. More lacking than having. More excluded than included. And if you're one of the least, the lost, and the left out, then you're my friend. See, the truth is that we all struggle with sin. And all of us are scared to death that our sin is going to be exposed. And so we keep it all hidden, and we play this great charade that accomplishes nothing. Oh, people are going to reject Jesus because they love the darkness more than the light, or people just won't love them the way they really want to be loved. But hopefully, sinners do not reject Jesus because they feel judged and condemned in the wrong way by the body of Christ. Finally, there's Jesus. Well, this guy is cool, calm, and collected. There's no fear. There's no panic. He's in control of the situation. With one word, he completely cuts through the attack of these Pharisees and he leaves them hanging their head. He levels the playing field between the woman and the leaders. He obliterates the idea that they are superior to the woman and somehow religious performance and morality are more acceptable to God. The leaders themselves have to come to grips with their own sin. How does Jesus respond to the woman? I think in two ways. His first response is total compassion and total forgiveness rather than condemnation. As he looks at this woman, we could read the words of Brenna Manning. His eyes called out to her, "Come to me. Come now. Don't wait until you have your act cleaned up and your head on straight. Don't delay until you think you're probably properly disposed and free of pride and lust, jealousy and self-hatred. Come to me in your brokenness and sinfulness, with all your fears and insecurities, and I will comfort you. I will come to you right where you live and love you just the way you are and not the way you think you should be." Brenna Manning tells a story of how he woke up from a drunken stupor in a doorway in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. When he woke up, he had vomit on his sweater and no shoes. He looked out and he saw a young woman coming down the street, an attractive woman about 25 years of age, and with her was a 4-year-old boy. And the boy broke away from his mother and ran up to Brenna Manning. And the mother came after her son and cupped her hands over his eyes and said, "Don't look at that filth." Jesus looks at this woman and sees no filth at all. None. He loves her completely in her filthiness and unworthiness, as if she is the only person in the world, as if she is the precious daughter of God. Would it matter what her sin might have been? I don't think so. She could have been guilty of all kinds of sins. What if she had been a woman who had been caught in a lesbian affair? How did Jesus have reacted to that? Exactly the same. Jesus knows she's guilty. She knows she's guilty. Jesus doesn't have to hear gory details. He doesn't have to psychoanalyze her. He doesn't have to get a written statement, a confession. He simply tells her that no one condemns her, and he doesn't condemn her either. Jesus says to her, "Your heavenly Father loves you completely in your filth. And he will love you tomorrow, and the next day, and the next day, and the day after that." The woman is one of the least, the lost, and the left out who was passionately embraced and loved by God. Jesus didn't come to condemn the world. He came to save the world and to offer his love and his grace. Now, the second response does have to do with sin, which indicates to us that it is important to him. But he simply tells the woman not to do it anymore. Amazing. Now, I don't think that means that if you stop sinning, then you can come to church and God is going to accept you. I don't think it means that we'll never sin again. I don't think it means that we can go out and do whatever we want because Jesus won't condemn us. It simply means that when we have an encounter with Jesus, when we look into his eyes, we can turn away immediately from the things that enslave us. We can turn away immediately from shame and guilt. We can live in forgiveness. We don't have to listen to other people who might condemn us, and we do not have to listen to ourselves, our greatest enemy, telling ourselves that we are unworthy and not forgiven. We receive mercy, and the response to mercy is to live joyfully in a love relationship with God. And if you're like me, with my tendency to punish myself and beat myself up, then you need to hear this message over and over and over again. You are radically and completely loved by God. Just go in freedom and in joy today. Today. Is that what we believe about Jesus? Is that what Jesus gives us? Now, here's the amazing thing to me. Jesus doesn't know if this woman wants his grace or will respond to his grace. But that doesn't matter. Jesus just pours out his grace. He just gives it free of charge. He's not worried about how she's going to respond. He's not worried about trying to follow up and see if she gets it right. The outcome is going to take care of itself. The only clue we have is that she does call him Lord. See, the story is an example of what Jesus is like and what the church should be like. And our first response to anyone who walks in that door or to each other is grace and compassion. Not judgment, not condemnation. We're to offer one another what Jesus offered to the woman. We don't try to investigate to see how deep the sin goes or question a person's character or motive. We don't have to compare ourselves to one another because all of us, each and every one of us, are in the same place. We are humbly in need of God's grace and forgiveness. God loves the least, the lost, and the left out. And we can love Him as well. When I became a Christian in my early 20s, after being very lost, I found a poem in my grandmother's Bible that it's always been a great encouragement to me. Maybe it'll be an encouragement to you. It's entitled The Touch of the Master's Hand, and it goes like this. 'Twas battered and scarred, and the auctioneer thought it scarcely worth his while to waste much time on the old violin, but he held it up with a smile. What am I bidding, good folks, he cried. Who'll start the bidding for me? A dollar, now two, only two. $2, and who'll make it three? $3 once, $3 twice, going for three, but no. From the room far back, a gray-haired man came forward and picked up the bow. And wiping the dust from the old violin and tightening up all the strings, he played a melody pure and sweet as an angel sings. The music ceased, and the auctioneer, in a voice that was quiet and low, said, now what am I bid for the old violin? And he held it up with the bow. $1,000, and who'll make it two? $2,000, and who'll make it three? $3,000 once, $3,000 twice, going and gone, said he. The people cheered, but some of them cried, we do not quite understand. What changed its worth? The man replied, the touch of the master's hand. And many a man with life out of tune and battered and torn with sin is auctioned cheap to a thoughtless crowd, much like the old violin. A mess of pottage, a glass of wine, a game, and he travels on. He's going once, he's going twice, he's going and almost gone. But then the master comes, and the foolish crowd can never quite understand the worth of a soul and the change that's wrought by the touch of the master's hand.